Okay, so whatever, whatever you would like to start.
I'm sure it's going to be a collaborative and community collaborative version. Community collaborative, we have to call this meeting to order. Public comments, we're going to take a roll call. Bill Hall, I'm here, Mike Humphrey. It's Mike here. We'll check this for you.
Okay.
Steve Berg, I'm here. David Franklin, is he in?
Yes, I'm here.
Dave's in. I feel there. He's there. Okay, Mike there? No? Okay. Recording on the, meeting collaborative virtual order. Bring public comment. The meeting is roll call. Bill Hall, I'm here, Mike Humphrey, is Mike in yet? Nope. Okay, Susan. Steve, I'm here. David? David is in, I believe. Okay.
Yes, Mike here.
And that's it, right?
Mike Humphrey just arrived.
Humphrey's Academy of Adult Education, I'd like to call the meeting to order. Roll call, Lee Patel here. Charlie Padilla, present. Tom Schaaf, here. Tal Pack, I'd call the meeting to order. Roll call, David Franklin. Here. Kelly Wiley, absent. Steve Berg, present.
So you want to go down the line?
Can we talk for 1 second?
Hello, Kelly.
I'm sorry, Bill. Did you get the time to turn up?
No.
Hold on, turn on. We're waiting for David Franklin.
Heard of mine in the wrong meeting. This is Mike.
Hey, Mike, there you are, buddy.
You are
in the meeting.
Okay,
Mike,
here. Am I in the right meeting?
Yes,
you are. Can you hear us, Mike?
Yes, I can hear you, yes.
Okay.
Okay, I'm going to go ahead and call County Collaborative to order. Roll call, Bill Hall, I'm here. Mike Humphrey?
Here.
Larry Alvarado?
Here.
Pete Knapp?
Here.
Steve Berry? I'm present. Dave, all present. County for us.
We're going to be judges.
Here.
What do we have, Mr. McInerney?
Well, we have an oral presentation. The structure of the collaborative by Gray T. Moser, partner of Procopio Law, Susan Carl Yoder, DMS.
Heidi Gaska.
Heidi.
Oral presentation by Gray Moser and the partners of Procopio Law Office and Carl Yoder, Delta Management Police.
Okay. Just to clarify, did you do CCCM, CCDS, and County?
Got them all. All right, Tom.
Eventually, Board of Director study session, the structure of the collaborative, presented by Greg Mosher and Carl York.
There it is. I think what might be the best thing to do before we actually begin is maybe go with introductions, so we can get a flavor of who is here. I'll go ahead and start myself. I'm Kurt Mann, CEO.
Who are you?
I'm the director
on DMS.
He's very board member.
So long, board member.
I think, again, as we've talked about, outcomes And we talked about things that we really want to accomplish today. I would say this is really about furthering our knowledge and education about really where we stand in the organization, in the organization of charter world, and see what we need to possibly do. And I've been beyond impressed with the dialogue from Carl, from Craig, and from Kevin to bring to you this presentation. Keep in mind that I think the presentation that we have here is going to kind of guide the conversation. And I know that you've all done this before, but keep in mind what you see in front of you wasn't a 10-minute, say, Greg's literally coming down Highway 5 and he's scratching off notes real quick. I say that very clearly because we have gone through various revisions. Even Carl, but Art tells Corey and I, hey, we'll be done with this in 30 minutes.
Hello. Can you hear us? We lost our audio. I'm not sure if you can hear those of us online.
I can hear. It's Mike Humphrey. I had a star six to become unmuted.
Star six. Okay.
We've been able to really learn to get the best of the best. And when Carl, whispered or said that Greg is considered one of the best, he didn't have to say much more because that's our organization. We want to align ourselves with the best people. We might not have the best, we might not have all the answers today, but I know that we're going to search it out. And I think if you look at this, we've got time in front of us. That's a good thing. We learned earlier today that Senate Bill 126 is only 15 people. And we are really being proactive. We feel like we're in a good position. So without further ado, I will go ahead and turn it over to Greg. And I've gone through this several times. The best thing to do is let's just do a little session, stop, ask questions. We'll go to the discussion, and we'll do it in chunks. We keep on going, It's really going to kind of create more problems with the tech data set. So, Greg, right, I'll turn it over to you.
Okay. When I first started working with her in 1995, and the school district came to me, we just created a company called Charter School. We don't know exactly what it is. We want you to protect us from these people because we think they're kind of crazy. And so I said, well, I know how to protect an organization from liability for a bunch of crazy people. I incorporated that in 1995, which that was the first incorporated charter school in the state. At a time when the Attorney General was telling people that was not allowed. We have, since that day, been gradually refining and changing corporate structures for charter schools to fit the needs of the charter sector. And so that's part of what we're doing today. We're responding to the new legislation that passed last year, both SB 126 and AD 406, and some of the other laws that are with charter organizations that have managing components in them. There are lots of different configurations around the state, so what we thought we would do is present one new idea. I think it's new to the charter sector, but it's not a new idea, which we'll go over. And kind of but start you from where you are, look at what options you have for structuring your business going forward. And why we think this new structure might actually serve you well. So let's start with the current corporate structure. You've got five nonprofit corporations that each operate one or up to four charter schools. So you've got 11 charter schools. Unlike most groups of charter schools, my understanding is that the origins of the different corporations were separate. You didn't start out as one corporation that replicated, which is the typical path. You somehow came together. I don't know how you came together, but
are today. Three of the corporations are service employers. Two of the corporations are not service employers, and so you've got seven schools that are service and four that are not. The corporations are legally separate. There's no corporate connection between any of them, except that you've got some overlapping directors, which is the subject of our closed session. The other relations between the schools are really contractual, and so you are sharing some services. We haven't looked at all of those agreements, but our understanding is that they're different depending on which school needs what services. You've got employees being shared, you have other resources being shared. But it's not necessarily consistent from school to school to school. The thing you have in common is that none of your schools are traditional brick and mortar schools. Your virtual schools, your independent study schools. And so that's kind of what you look like today. Some shared management across all of the schools that you really like and you want to make better. And I think what you should be looking for is a path forward for potential growth, either to add additional charter schools or to even bring in other schools. So what we're trying to present and offer for you are some different options for how you look at here. So let's start with the traditional charter management organization structure, or CMO, in the state, of which there are quite a few. What historically has happened, whether it was IIM many years ago, or FUC, or High Tech High, if you had a program that was successful, and so the school decided they would replicate their same model. Usually they have a similar curriculum, they may have software they developed, and so the original charter school would create subsidiaries. You have a parent and you have subsidiary corporations, each of which are essentially replications of the original successful model. So that is what the typical CMO organization looks like. That is what the legislation, we'll go into a little more detail about why the legislation targeted that, but basically what happens is the parent organizations that didn't actually have a charter school within them, the legislator and the authorizers said, we want visibility into that parent organization, even though it doesn't actually have a charter school that it operates. And so the new legislation came effective this last year and this year, and really aimed at that traditional structure of a charter school parent that's just a management company and a bunch of subsidiaries, which are the charter schools that are replicated. So that's what it typically looks like. Now, from a corporate law standpoint, the way that was all held together, the way that is held together, is that the parent company is the owner of the subsidiaries. It's an owner in the sense that a shareholder is an owner. Called a statutory member. The statutory member has the right to control the boards of all the subsidiaries, either by appointing them or approving them, or somehow having control over the majority of the subsidiary corporation's board. The member, the shareholder, the parent company, doesn't get to approve day-to-day activities of the subsidiary, but subsidiaries can't run away. They can't merge with another organization. They can't dissolve. They can't change their purposes without permission and approval of the parent company because it's the owner, the statutory member. So because nobody in a practical sense really owns the nonprofit corporation, the assets of the nonprofit corporation are covered with a charitable trust so that they're to be used in perpetuity for the charitable purposes for which the corporation was originally established. It's not like you can take money out of a nonprofit corporation. So when a nonprofit corporation dissolves, its articles typically say that the assets have to go to the same charitable organization or form. In a parent subsidiary traditional CMO organization, what that means is you have an unsuccessful school, it's got to be dissolved. Its assets, the parent basically absorbs those assets and redeploys them for the same purpose. So that's normally how that works. So the traditional CMO structure, the parent is going to provide management services, software, joint buying, HR support, share intellectual property. So if you want to call yourself a CHIP school, you've got to have a license from CHIP, the parent organization, to use that trademark and that name, and to use other know-how and trade secrets that make a CHIP Academy school a CHIP school. So that's the traditional CMO structure. Any questions about that? So let me move on then to talk about what the new legislation did to the traditional CMO structure. So AB 406 last year banned for-profits from managing charter schools. But that doesn't mean that actually happened, because organizations like Connections Academy are still for-profits that provide pretty much turnkey services to nonprofits, which it helps create, that run charter schools all over California. But what the legislature said was, we don't want for-profits doing certain things, and they spelled out what those things are, and I listed them for you on the slide. They don't want the for-profits to control the boards, which is, you remember from the traditional structure, that's what the parent company was able to do, is able to do. We don't want them to hire and fire school staff. We want the nonprofit, local nonprofits to do that. We don't want them to do day-to-day management, although they come pretty close by raising recommendations and being consultants to the management of the local nonprofits. And we don't want the for-profits making budgetary decisions on behalf of the school. They can make recommendations, they can describe best practices, but they can't make the decision. So that was kind of step one, ban for-profits on the theory that the for-profits were somehow bad for public education, or were, you know, taking public funds for private purposes that they shouldn't do. Whatever the rules were that the legislature was trying to enforce by banning for-profits from managing charges in California. As a practical matter, less than 1%, I mean, very few charter schools in California were for-profit, but they attracted a lot of political heat, and so the legislature was trying to buy them. So step two was SB 126, which went through the legislature like a rocket without any amendments. I think there's one version of SB 126, and it was what the governor wanted. He got it through in about 3 months. It's a little ill-defined because it didn't get worked very well through the legislature. And it was aimed at saying that the public transparency laws, which are the COVID reading laws, whether it's the Brown Act or State versus Bagley Key, the conflict of interest laws, whether it is Government Code Section 1090, Critical Reform Act, or Section 1099, the incompatibility of office rules, that those are now all going to apply not just to the charter schools, but to the parent companies of traditional CMOs. The language in the statute says CMOs that function in much the same way as school districts. That's in the legislative history. But weirdly, they didn't define any further what a charter management entity is. So it's unlike the for-profit regulation, which says these are the things. If you do these things in your for-profit, you're prohibited. There's no description or definition of what a charter management organization is. There is a cross-reference in the legislation, 47604, which is the
for-profit regulation session. There are school districts today saying that you are a charter management organization as a nonprofit if you meet any of the criteria that would apply to a for-profit. I'm not sure that's right. The legislation is not very clear. So that's where we are today, where in a traditional structure, we have a parent organization that manages a bunch of replications. The assumption is that parent organization is not going to be subject to the open meeting laws and the other transparency laws, public records. So that's kind of where we are today. So we looked at your organization and have had extensive discussions with your folks about what alternatives you might have from here to go going forward. So there are three options we're going to talk through. One is to create something new. It's new and it's not new. It's what I'm going to call Charter Services Organization, or CSO, as distinguished from a CMO, Charter Management Organization, that is member-owned, which is the reverse of what I just described. You have a parent organization that owns, but fundamentally owns all the charter schools. This is the charter schools fundamentally owning the parent company. So it's not really a parent. That's why I say it's kind of a flipped model. We'll go through in some detail with that. Another option that a number of charter schools are proceeding with in this new environment is to merge all of the subsidiaries and the parents into a single organization. So there's one board, as opposed to the five boards you have today. This would bring all of your boards into one corporation, all the charter schools in one corporation. It's simpler, there are fewer meetings. We'll talk about the advance if you just do that. And the third option is to refine what you have today, but not create any new corporations, not go through the merger process. So we'll talk about the pros and cons for that.
Any questions so far?
Yeah, I do. So, a CMO, the school can't step down without the CMO approval. A CSO, how does that relationship work?
One more to that. Basically, the short answer is that the CSO is a service organization. It does not interfere with or control the governance of the charter school. Charter schools are completely alone. So forming a CSO does not require a material revision of the charter because governance is not affected. The board is not affected. Its relationship with its authorizer is not affected. So it doesn't have that story. So let's go through a little bit of what the CSO would look like if you went that direction. The five existing corporations would each be owners. So instead of having one owner, as in the parent subsidiary model, each of the corporations would be a part owner of the new organization. And so you get to vote either as a group or, you know, one-on-one for the directors of the new corporation. So there'll be a new board. The board would be elected or appointed either by the five corporations, might each appoint one, or you might have an election for you're going to have three members or you're going to have seven members, some other number of members of the board of the new nonprofit corporation. You would pick to decide how those people get elected to the new board. Each member, to be a member, you would also contract for services with the CSO. And so there's a joint ownership. In order to be a member, you have to contract with the CSO for service. That's kind of definitional. That's the qualification for being a member. And so your corporation would each adopt resolutions agreeing to be a member of the CSO. And you would also approve some kind of service contract that the CSO is providing. So is there a model for this that exists out there? not so much for charter school management, but every joint powers, every, just about every public agency in California gets insurance for something very similar. Their joint powers authority. And the joint powers authority ones for cities and counties and school district communities, organizations, joint powers authorities, where what the business of the joint powers authority is to write insurance for the members. And the members vote on who the board of the JPA is. The other model that's out there is CalPUS, right, which is a special education local plan area where every school district and charter school that is a member of the CalPUS gets to participate in governing for how special ed services are provided in that area for that group or organization. So this is a similar model, but not for insurance and not for special ed, but for charter and management services. So it's very similar. So what are the rights that the member has? So it looks exactly like the parent organization, except now it's not just one, it's multiple folks. So again, you get to elect or appoint a board member and then the meeting. You would approve changes in the articles and bylaws of the CFO. So it can't merge with something else. It can't run away from the group. You really control its destiny and what it does, but you control it as a group. Because you're members, you would have the right to look at the books and records of the CSO. So for the member corporations, there'd be full transparency into what the CSO is doing, its books. There's certain limitations on looking at specific employee records, because of employee privacy concerns, but in terms of the finances, the CFO would be transparent to members. You're not stuck with being a member. Part of the corporation code for these member organizations is you could always resign. The corporation could always say, don't want services from the CFO anymore. I'm leaving. And you could always do that. You have a right to do that. What you can't do is sell your membership. And it's not like, it's like stock, but it's not like stock. You don't own a nonprofit, but you could resign and walk away. By the same token, you could bring in new members to expand the group who are benefiting from the shared services. That reduces costs. So insurance JPAs are always trying to grow to spread their administrative costs broader and make their insurance that much better and that much stronger. You might want to grow, you might not want to grow, but you as members would decide who the other members could be. That would not be the decision. CSO board could recommend to you, but you would control who the members are and are not. And you could actually even set up a process for selling them if one of your members was misbehaving in some fundamental way. You could expel a member from the CSO. So that's an important thing to understand. Any questions?
So when you say members, you are saying the individual school.
So I'm saying the corporation. Corporations which have one school up to four schools.
Okay.
There's corporation by corporation. You could do it another way. What you could do is you could, for example, you could have some of the members, some of the corporations have more authority than other corporations. So your corporation that has four schools maybe could elect four board members, or you could do it by ADA.
You have schools are different in size.
Schools are different in size. You can have classes of members who have more or less rights to elect board members. So if you wanted to weight that in some fashion, you could do it. If you wanted to have it one for one for one, you could do it that way.
So each member can elect or appoint board representation. What if you have nine members? Does that mean you have to have a nine-member board?
No, you could decide that you've got a five-member board, and so the five-member corporation would vote for the board members that they want.
Okay, but then they also have the right to bring in another member. Then what happens?
Depends. Well, the bylaws of the corporation of the CSO, we describe how that works. I at what point do you have a board member, or do you not? Or maybe, you know, so in a world where you end up with 8-member corporations, then you still only have a 5-member board. And it's just a voting process, and not everybody gets elected or re-elected.
Maybe you could rotate.
You can rotate. You can devise how that works.
When you say you can determine the amounts that are on the board, again, you is the corporation, not
correct.
You when you're talking to the
community. We are just, you know,
want to clarify that.
Yeah, member, and I'm trying to be careful with
this,
to always use member as the corporation and not a member of the board or an individual director. When I say member, I mean the corporation. So the members would be expected to take their receipt for services. But one of the things that a member organization, which you know from other contexts, a lot of members pay dues to be part of their organization. And dues are a way of the CFO, in this case, raising money for whatever purposes. It might be for R&D. It might be for the cost of incorporating the CFO originally. So the dues structure is independent from the contractual services. You either have dues or you don't have dues. That would be something that the members would decide, the members would be able to vote on, and that the board, company board of the CFO would decide. So it's just a feature that a membership organization has that, you know, then has not been traditionally used in the charter sector, but you certainly could have a new structure. So the CFO would have its own executive director or CEO, which the boards of the CFO would hire and fire and evaluate. You could have a member right that the members have to approve whoever that CEO is. You wouldn't have the members doing day-to-day supervision because that's not practical. If you think about how a corporation really couldn't do that, but they could give direction to their representative who acts as the member to say yay or nay to a new executive director. But you can have control both ways, both from the CFO's board and from the members on key decisions that were made at the CFO. The CFO would have goods and services it was providing to the members. It wouldn't be stuck with exclusively providing to the members, but it would have to be mostly, because from a tax standpoint, the CFO is a supporting organization. So if most of its business was not supporting its members, it could potentially lose its tax incentive. So the model here is, if you want services from the CFO, become a member. And you would be careful about extending service contracts to non-members because of the tax implication. And let me just reemphasize that becoming a member of the CFO would not affect your individual corporation governance in any way. So authorizers might be interested in the fact that you're doing this, but could not change or control, I don't think, this through requiring you to do a material revision, a modification of your charter. Because nothing changes about your governance. It's just where you're getting certain services, whether legal services or, curriculum or anything else that you buy. This is just being like a JPA. Like everything an authorizer required material revision because some church will change which insurance company they were getting their insurance from, even with the JPA. So I don't think they would be able to do that. So I think that's an important advantage. So what does the CFO look like? As we've been talking about, the qualifications and the size of the board, you would decide about that. Now, it might or might not be subject to the Brown Act, and whether it is subject to the Brown Act will depend on how it's formed and who's on its board. So that's something that's a decision for you all, because we can we can design the CSO so that it, in our view, is not subject to the Brown Act. The board needs not be subject to the Brown Act. But frankly, the CSO board is not going to be very often. They're going to have the annual meeting for election of their directors. They're going to approve a budget. They're going to review their CEO. But I don't envision the CSO as having super regular meetings because it's not involved in day-to-day. The board there is not involved in day-to-day management. That's what its staff is doing. We also want to look at conflicts of interest because, again, let me say with the Brown Act, if you had, because you currently have overlapping boards, I could imagine a scenario where the CSO's board is the majority of one of your member boards, in which case, whenever the CSO board got together, you'd have a quorum of your school board, and then it would be subject to Brown Act. So we want to be thoughtful about who's on that CSO board, whether you want it to be subject to Brown Act. Similarly, you want to think through conflicts of interest that might happen where you've got members approving contracts with the CSO and just how that looks. So that's still to be kind of worked through. And then you might want to have some rules about the composition of the CSO board. But is that, going to the CELPA model or the JPA model, typically, you got a group of cities that are insurance pulled together. You don't see city council people sitting on that board. In a CELPA, you don't see elected school board members sitting on the CELPA. It's more staff. And that reduces the potential for conflict. You don't have to do it that way, but when these are, if you look at the comparable organizations, that's typically what they do. You have a lot of flexibility as to how you do. So one of the, when I was thinking about this with your organization, I was thinking that what you might end up with is a CEO of the CSO who basically did a lot of management across all your schools, coaching of your current principals or executive directors, and pretty much, the things that Kurt does today, you do with the school as the CEO of this corporation. I'm not happy with that way, and some of the discussions we've had over the last couple of weeks have been who fits where, what makes the most sense, given your history and what you need. And you have flexibility to do that, but when I think about this and kind of the value you all put in Kurt, that's where I think he lies and belongs as the head of the CSO. Because he's kind of been your consensus pick already. That puts him in a situation where he can do the most for the most folks. But you don't necessarily have to end up that way.
So, I can say one thing.
Yeah.
When you talk about CELPAs and how it stands and run that and that conflict of interest, I stand on a CELPA as a director of special education public schools for many years. And I can say there is conflict because I am looking out for the interests of my school versus his district, and his district. So conflicts do happen when staff is involved with that. So I just wanted to make that, living in that situation.
Sure. Well, I'm not saying no conflict happens. I'm saying it happens. It's your school to have a claim from one of the members. Well, in everybody's interest not to pay that claim. But by the same token, everybody recognizes that they need to. Organization to claim, and you don't want to be treated fairly.